Well, good morning to everybody. Glad to be with you. Glad to have the chance to see you after having been sick. And I don't know if I'm talking about me or you having been sick. The old joke, please help those, the poorly worded prayer, please bless those who are sick of our church. It's one of my favorites. There was a lot of people who were sick from this church over the last week. And so I'm glad that we can be together. And I know that there are some who are still sick, and we need to keep praying for them. It's this time of year when we're getting sick and some people are traveling and different things like that are going on that we start to feel the pinch or the vacancy in our numbers. And that's just the natural kind of ways that things go, that sometimes a year there's a lot more empty chairs than others. And that isn't necessarily a barometer of the health of a church. And it's important to remember that when we look around and see empty chairs and feel bad or feel frustrated or just try to figure out, well, what does that mean? Empty chairs, that's just an empty chair. I think the health of a church is more based on how active each of us are when we are here, or if we can't be here, what are we doing and how are we as individuals contributing? And then when everyone starts getting sick, we start seeing that the pinch shows up in how many song leaders do we have, or okay, now we have only no song leaders doing the song leading tonight. That's when those sorts of things start to show up. Now, the number of song leaders and the number of teachers is not a barometer to the health of a church. Thank God. I heard someone talk about you get what you pay for, and we don't pay our song leaders and we don't pay our teachers. I mean, that's just the reality. It's everyone jumping in, everyone helping out, everyone stepping up to pray, the men who come up to lead a prayer, and then each of us who are praying with the men who do that. But it does, it's important to recognize that each of us need to think about who we are and what we're doing to contribute. What kind of church do I go to? What kind of church are we? What kind of member am I here? There's a lot of ways that you can gauge. Are we a big church? Are we a small church? What are we doing? Am I a child at this church? Am I an adult? Am I an old person? There are a lot of different ways that we can answer all those questions. And I just want to encourage you to think about who you are and what your sisters and brothers need from you and the way that you can help everybody out. And another thing to think about with that is the way we go to, treading delicate topic here, the way we go to church is going to change over the years. Jesus is saying yesterday, today, and forever, but 2020 demonstrated that going to church was going to change. And we can argue about how some of those things happen, but things change. And we're also thankful that 2020 wasn't a change that didn't revert. I mean, now we're kind of doing things as normal, but are we a church of a certain size? Am I a member at a church of a certain age? Well, sizes and ages change, and so my work or what I can offer or how much I need is going to change over time. And so the way you went to church 5 years ago may be different today, and maybe you need to do more, or maybe you need to pass on labors to others. And these are just things that I think it's important for all of us to think about. And it's easier to notice the needs when half the members are sick and at home and we're struggling with those sorts of things. And so I just want to, that's not what the lesson's about at all. But that's just something that I want you to think about. I'm always looking for more teachers. We're always looking for more servants and more workers. And I just want to encourage you to think about who you are and how you can help your sisters and your brothers in the congregation here. I want to talk about the idea of debt. The original title for the sermon was Debt, but I decided to give you something extra there, Communicating the Problem of Sin. Now it sounds like a very formal title. It's still just debt in my computer, so if you want the boring title, you can have that. I'm borrowing this lesson from Brother Shane Scott. When I was down in Florida, I worshiped with him at Valrico on Sunday morning, and he had a very simple, good message that he presented. And one thing that I like to do when I'm hearing other preachers preach, and it doesn't work here because they're doing it here, when Matt's preaching, when Matt's presenting a lesson, he's going to sound a lot different from me, and deciding, ooh, I need to do that sermon, doesn't work because y'all heard it right when I did. But whenever I go anywhere else and I hear other preachers preach, I hear them say things or present ideas or go in a direction that I never would think of. And I think it's important for me to sometimes copy those, because you'll never hear this sermon from me unless I'm hearing somebody else's idea. And I don't think there's anything wrong with the lesson. That's why I'm doing it. It just struck me as Mr. Scott was preaching, I thought, wow, I would never think of doing that sermon, or that's so simple, or you know, just it's just a very straightforward lesson, and I wanted to talk about it today. So I wanted to make sure that you knew who I am borrowing this from. In Matthew chapter 12, we have the very simple part of the prayer that Jesus teaches. Forgive us of our debts as we also have forgiven our debtors. Debt is used in the Bible to communicate the nature of sin, or the way that sin works and operates, or just the nature of mankind in general. I think it's really fascinating that when we read Matthew chapter 6, verse 12, forgive us our debts, I don't think that people immediately go, wow, God's going to help me with my mortgage. That's not what debt means here. But there's no indication, other than it's Jesus speaking, that this has a spiritual meaning. In Luke chapter 11, verse 4, a similar statement, forgive us of our sins, for we freely forgive everyone who is indebted to us. Jesus makes that clear. But he says here, forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. We immediately go to the spiritual connection there. It's not God, help me out with the $5 I owe so-and-so. It's forgive me about something that's way more important than my mortgage and the $5 I owe somebody. I think that's really fascinating. Debt symbolizes and speaks to big, big, big ideas. Guilt and shame is a big part of it. It's a symbol for the great problem of sin. It's a symbol of the depth and the severity of the problem. When we're talking about the definitions of debt are really boring, so I'm pulling out some ideas that I got out when I was looking up the word, but it's talking about the things that are due. It is an owing or an obligation to another. It has that sense of you are behind where you want to be or where you ought to be. And I think it's really significant that when we are describing words this way, owing, obligation, or being behind, those aren't necessarily evil, wrong things, but there's this massive stigma with all of them. I'm behind. I've fallen behind. Oh, that's a problem for you. Debt always has that stigma and that weight connected with it. And I think that that's important as we think about the ideas of sin. There's that inescapable feeling. There's that discomfort that is included with the concept of debt. And we live in a world that's just, hey, home loan, school loan, car loan. Okay. Nope. You know, wow. Home loan, that how many hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt is that? But if you owe a favor to somebody, all of a sudden the weight of debt seems to rest on your shoulders. I think that that's really curious. If somebody saves your life, you owe them something. How do you figure that one out? In the Westerns, the guy would follow him around until the end of the movie, right? That's nice and clean. But if somebody literally saves your physical life, what do you owe that person? How do you handle the feeling and the obligation? These are just big, interesting ideas. And the Bible talks about them in this way so that we can think about it. We can think about Adam and Eve before they sinned. Wait, that doesn't really count. What did they owe God before this debt of sin kicked into gear, right? They already owed God. They owed God for breathing into their nostrils, for putting them in paradise, for giving Adam a companion, for making Eve to be companionable, for giving them work. There was the punishment connected. The work was going to be painful, but a human being without work of any kind is a sad, sad person. They were given dominion. They were given the place to rule, to tend, and guard and keep. They are made in God's likeness. They knew good. They didn't have to know evil, but they knew that which was good. Mankind begins behind. That's the nature of what we are. There's this obligation and this owing. For you formed my inward parts. God was already working on us before our cells knew how to work. And the New Testament speaks in a similar way. And so long before the fall, I don't know how long the word long means, but long before falling, we all owe. We're all in debt. It's this really kind of depressing. It doesn't have to be depressing, but it's a big and it's an intimidating idea how much we owe to God. God is the one who holds it all together. Jesus, it says in Colossians, he holds it all together. And I have this image of how else do the atoms not just shoot off? What keeps the electrons electroning? Why does matter hold together? And it's because of what God and what Jesus does for us. So this debt communicates our nature, and then sin just compounds that debt more and more and more. And so what is that going to do with your heart? And that's really the big question. Is that going to encourage your heart, or is that going to discourage you towards hate? Those are the two reactions that we end up feeling. Pride enters in. I don't owe anybody anything. Bootstrapped myself to the top, right? And none of that could ever be true. We want it to be true. We want to push people away. But we owe so much to God. God is not a really ugly loan shark. God gave and gave and gave and gave. And he continues to give. And so we don't have to be afraid in that sense. Yet, sin has entered the picture. Jesus teaches about debt in two parables. I want to look at Matthew chapter 18 first. I love Matthew chapter 18. Lots of foolish arguments coming around from the people there, and Jesus teaches some of the most vital and important ideas about letting people be and be lifted up and to share together and to come together. And in verse 21, Peter comes up and asks him, "Lord, how often will my brother sin against me and I forgive him? As many as seven times?" And I don't know if he's trying to show that he's done a lot or put a limit to how much we're going to give, but he's asking a question that's going to constrain, and Jesus opens it. Verse 22, and Jesus said to him, "I do not say to you seven times, but 70 times, seven times. Therefore, the kingdom of heaven may be compared to a king who wished to settle his accounts with his servants. When he began to settle, one was brought to him who owed him 10,000 talents. And since he could not pay, his master ordered him to be sold with his wife and children and all that he had, and payment to be made. So the servant fell on his knees, imploring him, 'Have patience with me, and I will pay you everything.' And out of pity for him, the master of that servant released him and forgave him the debt. But when that same servant went out, he found one of his fellow servants who owed him 100 denarii. And seizing him, he began to choke him, saying, 'Pay what you owe.' So his fellow servant fell down and pleaded with him, 'Have patience with me, and I will repay you.' He refused and went and put him in prison until he should pay the debt. When his fellow servants saw what had taken place, they were greatly distressed, and they went and reported to their master all that had taken place. Then this master summoned him and said to him, 'You wicked servant, I forgave you all that debt because you pleaded with me, and should not you have had mercy on your fellow servant as I had mercy on you?' And in anger, his master delivered him to the jailers until he should pay all his debt. So also my heavenly Father will do to every one of you if you do not forgive your brother from your heart." This parable reveals some big and important ideas. I was really excited about this picture, actually, by the way. We've got the servant begging the master, and then the servant literally strangling his buddy out in the street. It's a great picture. Luckily, we know that the strangler gets thrown in prison. Don't worry. It doesn't end just there. We see big ideas revealed in this concept here with debt. It's impossible. The debt is impossible. How do you repay God for breathing? If that was the only thing, right? How many breaths is it going to take to earn enough money to pay the first set of breaths? Like we cannot do this. It's impossible. The first servant in verse 24 owed 10,000 talents. the 10,000 number is kind of like the concept of zillion. You know, we can come up with the higher, the million, and then the billion, and then the trillion, and now we're doing it with the different bytes, the megabytes and the terabytes and the other bytes. And so we're coming up with bigger numbers because we're dealing with bigger things, but 10,000 was just their word for the big. He owed the million. He owed the billion. He owed the impossible amount. And that's the point here. It is impossible for us to pay, to repay, and to go back. And it's important to recognize that. We have an impossible task set before us, and it's not necessarily our task. But there's also this lifelong impression. This forgiven servant should have had a mark on his heart that whenever he bumped into a moment of needing forgiveness or needing to extend forgiveness, it's going to like a block, and you put the wooden blocks in the little holes and the square block and the square hole and the circle block. And this, he's got a mark on his heart. Here's the forgiveness block, and it fits right in, and I know what I need to do. I know how I ought to behave. It's been made. It's had this impression. What God did for me, I need to do. And that's the way that we have been engineered and designed to be. When we receive this forgiveness from God, we are ready to then extend it to others. And this man breaks that pattern. The impression was not made for whatever reason. He blocked it off or he refused it. He is not letting that behavior to continue. It's foolish to think that I can repay what I owe to God. But it's insanity to refuse to extend forgiveness to anybody else after the debt that was paid for me. But if we see the impossibility of our debt, if I can recognize there's no way I can repay this, if I can appreciate how much I owe to God, I think that's going to make a difference on my own heart, and that in turn make a difference on my behavior and interaction with others. This understanding is going to make a big deal. And I don't think that that means, oh, I just have to walk around remembering, I owe God so much, and the crushing weight of despair has me crawling on the ground like a worm. No one behaved that way, and people who are good in the Bible don't walk around there sobbing nonstop. But there's this gratitude and this fear that's going to show up in our lives. We are gracious, we have thankfulness, because we have been forgiven. And because we have been forgiven, we are happy to share our own gracious heart, our own forgiveness that we've received. We are sharing that with other people. We need to be infectious with our gratitude. We need to have received a big dose of it like a virus, and we're just coughing it on everybody we possibly can. Because they need forgiveness just as much as we need it ourselves. We're not begrudging our mercy. And that's what's going on here. Now, this is kind of a side point, and I don't want to make too much of this, but the fellow servants see the bad behavior, and they go report to the master. And I think that that might be a demonstration of they are so desperate to be thankful and to be gracious and to make sure that the right things are happening that when they see someone acting inappropriately, they call attention to it. I think that that's significant here. We are gracious because we have been forgiven. We are also going to have fear. It was not our payment. I didn't pay it. If Jesus paid it for me, I didn't pay it. It's my debt. And if he paid it off, I mean, it's 100% paid, but there's that sense of still, but I still owed it. It's paid for. But I'm still breathing, and I still owe for that. And I'm still walking on this globe, and I still owe for that. There's this sense of just because Jesus paid for it doesn't mean that my debt never was. And so there's that sense of reverent fear, that respect that it's going to drive us to respond to God with reverent fear. And if you jump over to Luke chapter 7, there's another parable in a similar way. I'm going to read the whole story because I think the story is important to hear the parable. Luke chapter 7, starting in verse 36. One of the Pharisees asked Jesus to eat with him, and he went into the Pharisee's house and reclined at table. Behold, a woman of the city who was a sinner, when she learned that he was reclining at table in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster flask of ointment, and standing behind him at his feet, weeping, she wiped his weeping, she began to wet his feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair, the hair of her head, and kissed his feet and anointed them with the ointment. Now when the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he said to himself, if this man were a prophet, he would have known who and what sort of woman this is who is touching him, for she is a sinner. And Jesus answering said to him, Simon, I have something to say to you. And he answered, say it, teacher. A certain moneylender had two debtors, one owing 100 denarii and one the other 50. And when they could not pay, he canceled the debt of both. Now, which of them will love him more? Simon answered, the one, I suppose, for whom he canceled the larger debt. And he said to him, you have judged rightly. And turning toward the woman, he said to Simon, do you see this woman? I entered your house, and you gave me no water for my feet, but she has wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You gave me no kiss, but from the time I came in, she has not ceased to kiss my feet. You did not anoint my head with oil, but she has anointed my feet with ointment. Therefore, I tell you, her sins, which are many, are forgiven, for she loved much. But he who is forgiven little loves little. And he said to her, your sins are forgiven. Then those who were at table with him began to say among themselves, who is this who even forgives sins? And he said to the woman, your faith has saved you. Go in peace. Again, this parable teaches two things that I want to draw out, at least these two things. That when we have an understanding or an appreciation or some sort of knowing, I owe, then it's going to draw me to God. Or it can draw me to God. Out of desperation for God to pay it, out of the need that I can't handle this myself, dear God, only you. And then, when it has been paid, that's only going to draw me that much more closely to God. It's interesting. The sin, the very thing that separates us from God, drives us to seek God. That doesn't mean sin's good. But it's going to drive us towards seeking and knowing and getting our connection with God. And the other thing about this parable is we might not know our debt. That's really one of the big parts of this parable, that that's what it's teaching, that we might not understand or appreciate our debt. I love this idea of describing it, right? When Jesus says, which one of them will love him the more? And the man answers, I suppose, for the man for whom he canceled the larger debt. Can you imagine the analytical, unimaginative mind approaching this, right? Oh, no. That means if I'm not forgiven very much, I'm not going to love God, right? You just don't, you don't understand anything if that's, if that's your question. You don't understand the idea of imagination and trying to know what's going on. The big question is, well, why have you been forgiven so little? Are you forgiven a little because you've only done a few sins? Number one, how many sins does it take for the debt to be insurmountable? Do you not know what sin is? And how can you count the number of your sins to be few? Any number of sins is so many. Are you forgiven little because you've asked little? Are you hiding sin and you're only bringing certain things out to God? Or, I think this is really what it gets at, do you just not care? Do you care so little that you're not going to God with the full openness and raw pain of your debt to get that all handled with Jesus' help? The problem here isn't, oh, I haven't sinned enough to love God a lot. The problem is, I'm a mess, and I'm not even thinking about myself clearly. I love this parable. I love the way it brings out the fact that when I recognize my fault and my sin and my shame and my guilt and my pain and the debt, it's going to drive me to God. And if I don't understand how much I have, then that's one of the reasons I haven't been pursuing God. Guilt and shame are a pain. I think guilt and shame are one of the few ways that we can speak to the world that doesn't know or care about God, because even they out there have guilt and shame. How can anyone address guilt and shame without a God who forgives? Guilt and shame are the way that we can measure our spiritual temperature, right? Oh boy, it's getting hot. I've got more guilt and more shame, and that's helped me recognize that the heat has turned up and things aren't good and things aren't right. That's how we can see, and that's how we can know. And if we ignore that pain, if we ignore those feelings, if we ignore the recognition of the barometer or the thermometer saying things are not right, we're just going to keep adding it on and adding it on. Again, I'm not saying find ways to make yourself depressed. Don't nourish that. But open your eyes when you feel that and recognize that you need God. That's what the lady did. Do you think it was embarrassing to come forward and pray on Jesus' feet the way she did? Crying? Kissing his feet? Or do you think the embarrassment and the shame of sin was so big that this didn't matter at all? And that's what we've got to figure out in our own mind. How to get our minds in order. Jesus lived without debt. And that's amazing. Jesus lived without debt. Number one, because he didn't sin. Number two, because, you know, Adam and Eve, even before they sinned, they owed God for breathing and for holding the atoms together. Well, Jesus invented and did all that. Somehow, the Creator became incarnate and kept the atoms of the universe still held together. Somehow, as a baby drawing breath, he made sure that breathing still worked all over the globe. That's kind of amazing. So Jesus lived like us, and he also didn't live anything like us. Because when he lived on this earth, he was tempted just as we are. Turn to Hebrews chapter 2. I want to read these couple passages. In Hebrews chapter 2, I'll just start reading in verse 14. Since therefore the children share in flesh and blood, he himself likewise partook of the same things, that through death he might destroy the one who has the power of death, that is the devil, and deliver all those who through fear of death were subject to lifelong slavery. Slavery is another good image to understand sin, not debt, but slavery. For surely it is not the angels that he helps, but he helps the offspring of Abraham. Therefore, he had to be made like his brothers in every respect, so that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in the service to God, to make propitiation for the sins of the people. Because he himself has suffered when tempted, he is able to help those who are being tempted. Jesus suffered like us. And just a page or so over, towards the end of chapter 4 in verse 14, since then, we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God. Let us hold fast our confession, for we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. He never messed up. He never made a mistake. He never got behind on the payments or on what he ought to have done. No sin of omission, even. Jesus always did the thing that he needed to do, and then on top of that, he paid our debt. The only one who managed to live debt-free, that's the only person who can pay our debt. And how much do we owe? How many lifetimes of living would it take to earn the money to pay for your first life of breathing, right? He paid and made propitiation on our behalf. The way, the truth, and the life somehow suffered temptation. That's an interesting idea. But the way, the truth, and the life, Jesus, was tempted. But since he's the way, the truth, and the life, he wouldn't succumb to that. And we need to live more like him. Turn a page or two over to 1 Peter chapter 1. Begin to wrap up the lesson. 1 Peter chapter 1, starting in verse 17. Jesus paid our debt, and that needs to leave a lifelong impression on our heart. Everything that we owe has been covered. Everything has been handled by him. 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 17. And if you call on him as Father, who judges impartially according to each one's deeds, conduct yourselves with fear throughout the time of your exile, knowing that you were ransomed from the futile ways inherited from your forefathers, not with perishable things such as silver or gold, but with the precious blood of Christ, like that of a lamb without blemish or spot. He was foreknown before the foundation of the world, but was made manifest in the last times for the sake of you, who through him are believers in God, who raised him from the dead and gave him glory, so that your faith and hope are in God. We need to conduct our days in fear. We need to somehow get that massive amount of fear and respect and reverence so that we will bow before God every moment of the day, even as we walk, standing tall, letting our light shine to the world. We need to be ready to be forgiving and to help and to show mercy, because we know just how much we needed it and still need it every day. We need God's mercy every day, even today. So we need to walk around in fear, appreciating the blood that paid for us and hoping in that one who paid for us. I want to close by looking at Psalm 49. Psalm 49 is one of a favorite psalm of mine. It has a really fun image in it. It's going to talk a little bit about debt. Mostly it's going to talk about money. This has not been a lesson about money, but it's been using debt and money to illustrate the need. Psalm 49 is going to demonstrate the futility. Psalm 49 is going to demonstrate the futility of trying to handle it on our own. Hear this, all peoples. Give ear, all inhabitants of the world, both low and high, rich and poor together. My mouth shall speak wisdom. The meditation of my heart shall be understanding. I'll incline mine ear to a proverb. I will solve my riddle to the music of the lyre. Why should I fear in times of trouble when the iniquity of those who cheat me surrounds me, those who trust in their wealth and boast in the abundance of their riches? Truly no man can ransom another or give to God the price of his life, for the ransom of their life is costly and can never suffice that he should live on forever and never see the pit. For he sees that even the wise die, the fool and the stupid are alike must perish, and leave their wealth to others. Their graves are their homes forever, their dwelling places to all generations, though they called lands by their own names. Man in his pomp will not remain, he is like the beasts that perish. This is the path of those who have foolish confidence, yet after them people approve of their boasts. Like sheep they are appointed for Sheol, death shall be their shepherd, and the upright shall rule over them in the morning. Their form shall be consumed in Sheol, with no place to dwell. But God will ransom my soul from the power of Sheol, for he will receive me. Be not afraid when a man becomes rich, when the glory of his house increases. For when he dies, he'll carry nothing away. His glory will not go down after him. For though while he lives, he counts himself blessed, and though you get praise when you do well for yourself, his soul will go to the generation of his fathers, who will never again see light. Man in his pomp, yet without understanding, is like the beasts that perish. We don't need to worry about all the monetary debt that we're all kind of worried about. That really doesn't matter. We need to know everything that we can so that verse 15 will happen. But God will ransom my soul from the power of Sheol, for he will receive me. What is it that I need to do to be with God, to be in God's favor, so that God will be willing to pay for me? The gospel is the answer to that. The gospel teaches that. The gospel shows us that Jesus Christ was willing to die so that we don't have to. Jesus Christ was willing to pay all of our debt so that we can be with him as brothers and with our Father in heaven. We have water for baptism. We have all of our collective will to pray for you if that's what you need. If there's anyone here who needs help or prayers, why don't you come forward as we stand and sing?